Hello and welcome to The Swiss Connection. I'm Susan Masika. In this edition, we're introducing a podcast series called Inside Geneva, where we're taking a closer look at the work being done by the international organizations that are based there. For example, how do humanitarian groups cope when politicians launch verbal attacks on refugees? Swiss Info correspondent Imogen Folks recently discussed that question with people who deal with it every day in Geneva.
Welcome to Inside Geneva, the podcast. This is where we unpick the big issues being discussed in this city, and we go behind the scenes to find out from aid workers, UN diplomats, and we hope ambassadors, how they're coping with some of the challenges. Today, our topic is one of those key challenges. It's refugees, asylum, and immigration. It's difficult, it's controversial, and lately, at least, the populist rhetoric seems to be beating the humanitarian message hands down. To look at that, I'm joined today by Liz Throssell of the UN Refugee Agency, Matt Cochrane of the Red Cross Federation, and our regular analyst, commentator, and devil's advocate, Daniel Warner of the Graduate Institute. But before we start our discussion, let's have a listen at just what aid agencies today are up against when it comes to populist rhetoric.
I mean, when you have 15,000 people marching up and you have hundreds and hundreds of people and you have two or three border security people that are brave and great.
If you allow hundreds of thousands of people to enter the territory of the European Union, does it give the opportunity for the terrorist organizations to send their terrorists to Europe? Yes, it does.
Sicuramente I colleghi ricorderanno.
Nigerian mafia, drug smuggling, prostitution, rapes, and homicide that cannot be forgotten.
Many that came, who were supposed to be children, actually were sort of 33-year-olds and looked like they'd be quite good in the rugby scrum.
You wouldn't believe how bad these people are. These aren't people. These are animals.
So that's the kind of thing, the kind of rhetoric we're hearing from some, not all, but some political leaders at the moment. And the thing is, some of it, apart maybe from that last comment, which I found a bit chilling, I think to a lot of people, it can sound quite reasonable, quite persuasive. So how do the big humanitarian agencies answer? Bit of history first. The UN Refugee Agency, founded in 1950, is dedicated to saving the lives of refugees and protecting their rights. And it currently cares for over 25 million refugees around the world. And then there's the Red Cross Federation for over a century. It's got volunteers in every country. And those volunteers are often the first on the scene in a major disaster. They regularly support people fleeing war, persecution, or famine. So Liz Throssell of the Refugee Agency and Matt Cochrane of the Red Cross, going back to that kind of rhetoric, it does seem to be winning votes. So how do you counter it? And actually, are you doing something wrong?
Well, we do stress the humanity and the individuality of the people who are concerned. You heard them talking about influxes and masses and animals, really dehumanising language. What we've got to do, and I think we've probably got to do better, that's absolutely clear, is really step up our own rhetoric, our own positive rhetoric, to really make the case why people should care, why people should listen, and why people should act.
Matt, caring, generosity, but there's no evidence that these things are vote winners.
I mean, the language is incredibly emotive, is it? I think what strikes me about listening to those clips is that there's nothing factual in there. It's all about emotion. It's all about painting migrants as the other, as dangerous. Whereas on our side, our response is often very factual, perhaps even for HCR, it's very legal at times because of the mandate. And for the Red Cross, it's very much around principles and traditions. And it's almost like, kind of, are we bringing a knife to a gunfight almost to
yeah, I agree. I mean, we do have legal language. What we also have is absolutely masses and masses of statistics and figures that do portray the situation. But people have to dig through to those statistics. And we probably need to do a better job of making the statistics really tell the story properly. Mm-hmm. we are trying to contest emotions with our facts, and maybe we need to bring more emotion into the debate.
Do you think that's right, Danny? I'm just wondering whether, I mean, do you think perhaps they should be playing even more hardball? When you hear the comments from the quite contemptuous comments from somebody like Nigel Farage we heard there, should they be really calling this out more clearly?
The question is, who's calling out? UNHCR, the Red Cross, both of them have a certain legal authority. What they don't have here is a political authority. And I think back to Sergio Vieira de Mello, when Sergio worked with the Vietnamese boat people, there was also a certain charisma. It wasn't just movie stars. It was Sergio. I think of Madame Ogata, who was saying, this has got to be something that we have to do. And I feel that there's not enough push, you say hardball, against this kind of rhetoric and just saying, no, you have a legal obligation, you have a moral obligation, this is the way it has to be. And I think that's something that's missing in the dialogue today.
But you talked about Sergio Vieira de Mello, Sadako Ogata. They were working at times when I feel there was a more receptive audience in governments. I mean, we had Bill Clinton and Tony Blair go to war in Kosovo, basically for the sake of refugees. Now, what we see, and this could be coming in the next few weeks or months, is suggestions from Washington in particular that billions in funding for aid agencies, UN aid agencies, will be cut, also presumed for the Red Cross. Does that worry you too, Liz and Matt?
Yeah, it hangs over us. I mean, you're talking about us having or not having moral authority. I think one of the things that we really weigh up, we struggle with, is that we want to remain true to our principles. We want to remain true. But there's some really difficult decisions to be made that if we don't have the money, we're not going to be able to help people at all.
So if you call them out, do you risk getting less money? Is that part of the...
That's part of the calculation. It absolutely is. I think it is something that we have to take on board. There are lots of discussions, lots of work behind the scenes. I mean, a lot of countries that are our big funders that give us money are also countries that are also putting forward this kind of rhetoric. So it is, in a way, a bit of a split personality on behalf of those countries. We're trying to navigate that. I think it's very difficult. You were making reference to the earlier days of Sergio Vieira de Mello. I think the problem for us now is that it isn't sort of a bipolar world. It isn't the democracies and the authoritarian governments, and we could go after the authoritarian governments because we had right on our side. We've now got to sometimes try and call out countries that have democratically elected governments but have very sort of populist leaders. So I think that has complicated it, and I think we're working our way through it. We haven't found the right solution. But I think what we have to keep at the forefront of our mind at the UN Refugee Agency is we have to do what we think is in the best interest of the people that we work with and for, and that's refugees and displaced people.
Matt, you wanted to come
in
there.
Yeah, I think, I mean, we were talking before, right, about have the rules changed, have the goalposts been moved? And I think the rule book has been completely, in some regards, been completely ripped up. And maybe it's up to us to realise that, and that the rules that we've, some of the rules that we follow, some of the approaches that we've taken are no longer applicable. I mean, I think there are some non-negotiables. I think we have to continue to insist that humanitarian need has to sit above or outside of politics, right? I think once we give that up for dead, then probably the game is over, and the price will be paid not by us, but by the people who really can't afford to get by without help. But I think, you know, do we start needing to come back to your point, Liz? Do we start needing to find our own rhetoric? Do we need to be slightly more bombastic? And maybe not in a sense of picking a fight because of the realities, the political and financial realities, but there are a lot of people out there, I believe, I absolutely feel this, they're in my family who are confused about this issue, who may not share the sentiments that we have sitting here in Geneva or sitting where we sit on the political spectrum, but haven't totally given over to the other side, to the less tolerant, the more crueler kind of view on this debate.
I think
we're not putting an argument forward to them because we're coming to them with statistics and with you know, recalling responsibilities under international law, and these are not evocative points that are going to move the needle one bit, I wouldn't think.
I mean, 2 points. First, the rule book has changed. I mean, you have a convention, 1951 Refugee Convention, which was after the Second World War. They tried to change it a little bit. Now we have a global compact on migration, which is soft law. In other words, we've gone from certain obligations, treaty obligations, to soft law, which certain countries, important ones, have not signed. But the second, about the confusion of getting the message across, without getting personal, the Secretary General of the United Nations is the former High Commissioner for Refugees. Shouldn't there be leadership coming from the United Nations on this issue? Because when you see the refugees, the migrants, you're asking, who's in charge of this? Is each country in charge, or are they working together? And there have been situations such as the Vietnamese boat people in the 1970s when the countries agreed, we would work together, you'll take this number, you'll take this number. What we see now is increased nationalism where there's no cooperation. The situation with the open arms boat is a perfect example. All the countries are doing individually, but there's no cooperation. That's not a change in the rule book. That's a change in multilateralism, and it's dangerous.
But how do you get past that? I mean, you know, I think many people in Geneva were very pleased when Antonio Guterres became Secretary General, somebody with the absolutely pure humanitarian pedigree. Okay, some politics as well, but really a humanitarian pedigree behind him. But he started that job at a time when a very senior aid official in Geneva told me that aid agencies, UN aid agencies, don't know who to talk to anymore. I mean, has Guterres ever been to the White House? I don't think so. Government leaders are just not so interested anymore. As you said, Danny, they are looking at their voters and seeing what wins them votes.
But the point about getting the message across, that's what I'm saying. Who's going to get the message across? Is it the agencies, such as the Red Cross or UNHCR? Is it leadership? Who are we all looking for? Someone to say to Mr. Trump, Mr. Salvini, someone to say, that's enough, I have a counter argument. It's not the argument that I'm saying that's important. It's the person who's saying the argument, and your two organizations have the moral authority to get that message across.
I think it is a challenge, and I think that's one of the reasons why we try to work with sort of partner organisations or partners to really sort of diversify the voice. Because the danger is we're always within our bubble. We have the messages that just resonate with people who hear them time and time again. And what we really need to do to get out beyond that bubble is to really diversify the way we present our arguments, the people that we work with. You're talking about sort of the UN. The UN is it's the member states as well, isn't it? And I do think the governments, the member states, they have to take responsibility for really sort of looking at these issues. So I think, you know, for us, it's really about trying to get out of our bubble, diversify our messaging, and try and make it stronger. But we're not there yet.
You know, I think we feel, well, I certainly feel, there is a compelling message to speak to that anxious middle. It may be there's a political cost to it, and I'm interested to hear, Liz, particularly what you think. You know, are we prepared to sort of say to governments, look, it's not for us to tell you how to manage immigration. I mean, there are constraints, and you should meet those constraints, and when you step outside that, then we need to speak up strongly. But let's talk about how you treat people. Let's talk about how you treat migrants. And what I see conflated, and going back to that package, Imogen, was we're mixing up controlling borders with punishing people. So all of a sudden, people drowning in the Mediterranean or being subject to horrific abuse in Libya or in any other part of the world is an acceptable means to an end of controlling the borders. Now, that's you don't have to unpack that too much to realize that's a truly horrible moral leap in judgment, right? So perhaps that is a pressure point where we can start saying, no, hang on, okay, let's leave the more political stuff aside, and let's focus on the fact that we can all agree that it's unacceptable for women and children to die in deserts and on oceans. It's completely unacceptable for people to be sent back to awful camps, to rape camps, things like that. Can't we find a common ground on that and focus on that? And perhaps there's a consensus there. I think of my own family in Australia and who struggle perhaps on the political side of immigration. But I know when I bring that conversation to this point around the inherent dignity, as you said, of every single person, you can begin to see that you're making a little bit of room. And maybe that's a space to look at. But again, it's yeah, I don't know. I'm interested to hear what
I'm asking whether we're getting into a situation of compassion fatigue. Mm-hmm. And I give the example of the Vietnam War. You have one photo of a girl having been subjected to napalm, And that turned hundreds of thousands, millions of people against the war. You've now had pictures and stories of kids dying on the beach, father, and one after another, and yet we don't seem to have the same outrage and reaction.
But we see these pictures all the time. We're bombarded with media. I think this is part of the problem. It's not just compassion fatigue. We are becoming immune to this.
Well, you're right. We are being bombarded. We are. I mean, we were talking about the image of Alan Kurdi, the little toddler, that sort of resonated, but didn't resonate the way that the image from Vietnam resonated. I think what we would think is that we're appealing to different types of audiences, and I think we talk to people who sort of instinctively sort of sympathise with what we're doing. And then you've got people on the other extreme that we're never going to convince. But it is that conflicted middle. And I think we do have to be better at really understanding them. I think it's absolutely right that sometimes people are a bit worried about immigration. You know, that their societies are changing, that their neighbourhood is changing. The fear of change is natural. But also, a very human thing is also to help the other, not just fear the other. Mm-hmm. And I think we could say there's compassion fatigue. But there are also lots of people who really do want to make a difference, do want to do something, and we've got to really be better at telling them what they should do. Mm-hmm. You see the inspiring example of the younger people, the climate change activists.
Yes.
That is very inspiring. And so I'm sure that's something we can build on. I don't think we need to be depressed and think all is lost. I think we've got to be realistic. But I think we've got to sort of say, this is what we believe in, this is what we're doing, and we need to not just say to people, this is terrible. We need to give them ways of actually changing the situation, giving them proper calls to action so where they can really do something.
I still think a lot of this, although you can do communication to a large number of people, I still think there's a leadership issue involved. I mean, we're all dealing with countries that have changed and the natives. So there is a fear out there. Mm-hmm. And the question, again, is to how you combat that fear. And that's why I think someone emotionally, you think of Churchill, we have nothing to fear. You think of Franklin Roosevelt. We don't have those kind of leaders today. And I think that's a huge problem. Whether it be Greta or an adolescent or an adult, no one is taking the moral high ground and saying, Mr. Trump, Mr. So-and-so, Madam so-and-so, that is not acceptable. That's not our values. That's not what we stand for. And having people listen to that and follow, not with statistics and facts, as you said before, as an emotional thing to give people confidence so they're not worried about these invasions, people taking their jobs and all the rest.
I think it was easier back in the day of Winston Churchill, though, for him to get his message across, because literally it was just the BBC, wasn't it? Let's face it. And now you've got...
No Twitter.
No Twitter. I'm sure he would have been an absolute star on Twitter. But, it is much harder. And it's too easy just to blame social media, but we are operating in such a different world, politically, socially, culturally.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think I'd come back to what you said about politicians with vision and Sergio Vieira de Mello and so on. And at the moment, you get this feeling that we're living in a time where politics has become quite narrow and nativist and nationalist. And I don't want to say, oh, these words are really wrong. But as you said, Matt, if it comes to how people are treated, if the language then leads to, encouraging people to be treated badly, we have a problem. The humanitarian values of the planet have a problem.
Absolutely. I mean, again, the game's almost up, right? I think that's a bit, probably a little bit dramatic, but once we start accepting that it's acceptable for people to be mistreated or not helped, that it's an acceptable means to a political end or a policy end just to leave people to drown in the Mediterranean, or to separate families, or to not provide basic protections to children, then, it's almost unconscionable, right? Thinking back even 5 or 10 years ago.
And to criminalise people who tried to help them as well.
Absolutely.
Which we haven't even got to yet. But this, again, is concerning that we have international law, international maritime law about rescue at sea, but some countries south of here have said, well, no, if you go into the waters and sail a boat and rescue people, we will prosecute you.
It's also not on the humanitarian sector to completely solve this either, right? And I think I completely agree with Liz that we need to be much more, much stronger, much braver, and we need to get out of our heads and get out of our books and actually stake a moral, defensible position. But a humanitarian organization has never solved the problem. We're there because
not the political problem.
No, exactly. No,
separate the political from the humanitarian. Yeah.
No. But I mean, it's you know, I think of our president Francesco Rocca, who's been a strong advocate from his time, as he still is, as president of the Italian Red Cross, and really was one of those first voices on the shore, going back a number of years and talking about the dignity of the people arriving. And he talks about this move towards the criminalization of groups in, I think, a really compelling way. And he makes the point that, like, imagine if governments asked firemen to assess the status of people in a burning building. I mean, that's completely unacceptable, and that's exactly what we're talking about now. And the most important thing is that the people are getting assistance, that people are getting support and care when they wouldn't otherwise. And if that means that we say something, then we say something, and oftentimes that means that we keep mum. But as long as we feel that the people who need help are getting help, then that's, I guess, the North Star. Now, whether that's happening all the time, sure, but...
I think it's a debate that is going to go on and on and on, but it's all we've got time for today. Thank you all very much, Liz Throssell, Matt Cochran, Danny Warner, for joining us. A reminder, you can send us suggestions for what we should talk about in the next podcast. Find our contact details on the Swiss Info website. Thanks very much for listening.
That was Imogen Folks reporting from Geneva as part of our new podcast series looking at the international work being done there. Visit us at swissinfo.ch for more news and background on what's going on in that city as well as throughout Switzerland. We produce the Swiss Connection every few weeks, so follow us on Twitter or Facebook for a heads up when our next podcast comes out. Better yet, subscribe on iTunes to ensure that you don't miss any episodes. Thanks for listening, and thank you to studio technician Donnie Wheeler. Signing off for all of us here, I'm Susan Masika.
Hi, my name is Fabio Canich. I'm the host of another Swiss Info podcast, The Geldcast. I'm a journalist and lecturer on international monetary policies. In my podcast, I talk to finance experts, politicians, and people in the banking industries on money-related topics. This podcast is from the land of money, Switzerland. It is published bi-weekly on YouTube. Highly valuable content, but free to listen to.